This class was recorded in June 2016 at Herbstock, Boston's homegrown herbal conference. The presenter is Katya Swift, and the title is So, You Want to Be an Herbalist? For more information about our school and clinic, please visit our website at commonwealthherbs.com. Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah, we can do it.
So, we have musical accompaniment today. That would be awesome.
Should I shut the door, do you think? Or?
It locks if we shut it. We can shut it some, but it locks if we shut it. But also, music is nice.
Cello's pretty good,
yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
All right. Well, hi, you guys. So, I'm Katya. And
I'm Rin.
And we are the directors of the Commonwealth Center for Holistic Herbalism, which is a great big mouthful. You get bonus points if you can say it 5 times fast. Mm-hmm. But it's one of the herb schools in town. And we're going to do a class that is about how to be an herbalist, right? So you guys all think plants are cool, I'm assuming. And you'd like to maybe get some more of them in your life. And maybe you're wondering exactly how do you take the next steps? Like where do you go from here? And so we're gonna talk about that. I wanna say from the outset that this is it's only a 6-page outline, but that there's a lot of talking I can do in 6 pages. But this outline with a lot of great information in it is available at the Herbstock website, or also at our website, commonwealthherbs.com/herbstock. Also, the recording from this class will go up there, too. So if you're thinking that maybe you'd like to listen to it again someday because you enjoyed it that much, it's going to be available for you free there. So that'll be really good. And I'm going to apologize ahead of time that I am going to use the notes, because if I didn't, this class would be about 10 hours long. Mm-hmm. So we're gonna have these notes keep me accountable here, and that'll be great. Do you want to hold it? Will that kill you? Will you be like, this is the worst half hour and a half I've ever spent?
Where is it?
It's right here. So this is one of our teaching interns, Leon Bruno, who also has just started her own herbal company called Sterling Smokes. Her website is sterlingsmokes.com. And she and another one of our students has herbal smoking blends that are really, really awesome. So if after you take this class, or after you sit through this class, you're feeling really inspired, you should totally talk to Sam and Leon about actually putting your herbalism into real live dollars and cents practice. So also at our table upstairs, we have a few of our other students who are in our third and second year programs who are also like starting to make this into a livelihood. So go and like pick their brains about what it's like. But let's start off here first. A really good place to start, and also in the materials that are online, there is a brief history section, because if you're gonna be a thing, right, if you're gonna identify with a thing, it's pretty useful to know the history of that thing and sort of how it's developed over time and where it's coming from and how you fit into that history. So there is a section on history here, but if we went into that, then we wouldn't get to the nitty-gritty stuff. So I'm going to let you read that. And also last year at Herbstock, we spoke about a very long class about the history of herbalism, and that recording is also available at the website, commonwealthherbs.com/herbstock, so you can listen to that as well. So we'll start with, what is an herbalist, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
It's a person who thinks plants are cool.
Pretty much.
So I suppose we could define that as anybody who is involved in growing, making herbal products, teaching about herbal things, helping people in a clinical way, so talking to people about their health and how they can work with herbs to improve it. Any of those kinds of things, all those things are herbalists. But also, what about a nurse who brings herbalism into her holistic nursing practice, right? We also teach pharmacists from the two pharmacy schools in Boston, and they're herbalists too, right? Even though they go to work every day in a pharmacy, there still is a part of them that's an herbalist, and they're taking that into their everyday work. So an herbalist isn't necessarily some long-haired hippie who lives on a farm. That sounded a lot better before I chopped off all my hair. But it's like there's so many different ways to be an herbalist in this world. Also, it doesn't necessarily mean that that's your only job. You're not an herbalist if it's not your full-time job, right? Lots of professional herbalists, lots of nationally recognized herbalists still have a day job or two, right? Jim McDonald, who I highly recommend, you can find his stuff online at herbcraft.com.
org.
A phenomenal herbalist, teaches at all the conferences, still has a day job. Yeah, no problem. So that's not a requisite. You don't have to quit your job and move to a farm to be an herbalist. There's a whole list, an herbalist named Sevensong, who's in Ithaca, New York, has this whole list of ways of being an herbalist. I'll share some of them with you. Farmer, medicine maker, apothecary, medic, ooh, that's a really good one. Clinician, teacher, curator of botanical gardens, libraries, and collections. Designer of herbal equipment, like you may have seen some of the hydrosol and essential oil distilling apparatus around. And so like that person's a glass blower, but they're also an herbalist, right? Isn't that cool? A person who makes herbal-related software. Like, you know, there are apps for your phone that help you identify plants and stuff like that. So cool. Conservationists, forester, chemist, promoters. Yes, please. We have a student actually who came to us from working at a local college as the head of social media for that college. And that's actually what she does as an herbalist too. She does see clients and she does grow plants and make some cool things, but actually she helps herbalists to do social media stuff. Like, how cool is that? Anyway, all different kinds of ways that you can be an herbalist, and the list goes on and on. We like to think of it as a street fair, right? So if you go to, you know, your favorite street fair or your town fair or whatever, there'll be the guy with the fried dough, and when they invent that gluten-free, I'll be pretty excited. And there'll be like the face painter, and there'll be like some bands, and there'll be somebody with hula hoops, and there'll be all these different things in the street fair. And the street fair wouldn't be a street fair without all of them, right? You need some of all the things. So that part's a really, really important message to have right off the bat. Even as you look upstairs at all the herbalists who are selling things upstairs, none of them are competing with each other, right? We have one student who loved to say that, you know, all of the colors of crayons, they don't compete with each other. The crayons are competing with markers. But all the different colors of the crayons, they're all the colors of the crayons, right? So another way I like to talk about this is that we all speak different languages. Even if we're all speaking English, if I say the word, ready, if I say mother, everybody just heard a different word, right? Because you all have different relationships with your own mom than I do. And so that word has different meaning to you than it has to me. And so even if we're all speaking the same language, we still have our own ways of relating and communicating. So we need as many herbalists as possible who can speak all of the languages that you all speak natively, right? Your own way of relating to the world, because the way that you do that is the way that you're going to relate the plant world to other people, right? So in that regard, we need all of you in all the different ways. Great. So how can you learn to be an herbalist, right? The first thing is you're going to need some education. That's a good thing. There are lots of herb schools around out there. There's herb schools that are in person. There's herb schools that are online. There are schools that are a combination of both. And finding the right herb school for you is really, really important. Herbalists are personalities. There's no way to get around it, right? Like we all kind of have our personas, and they'll be like, oh yes, that's, you know, that's this herbalist and that's that herbalist. And it's kind of true. It's almost like a caricature, right, of ourselves. And that's okay, because we all have a style, and And we kind of embody that style. I guess I'm like the lavender crayon in the box, and you can be the sage crayon in the box, and you know, all the different colors. Somebody is a calendula crayon in the box. Maybe that's Steph this year. So it's really important when you're choosing a school that you choose a school whose personality fits your personality, right? Visit the school before you send them money. Most herb schools have some drop-in classes that you can take. Maybe it'll be a two-hour weeknight class. At our school, we do those Wednesday nights, every Wednesday night from 7 to 9. Take that class. Just drop in. Go in and see. Are you comfortable in the space? Do you feel, when you walk into the space, do you feel really excited to be there? Does it make you feel warm and inviting in whatever that is for you? Or does it feel weird when you walk in, right? Because a person will make their space resonate with their personality. So if you resonate with the space that an herbalist is working in, it's more likely that you also are gonna resonate with their style of teaching, right? So that's the first thing. And then sit down and listen to them teach. Because if you're gonna spend 9 months, we have a 1 year program and we have a 3 year program. Holy cow, if somebody's gonna spend 3 years learning with us, they better feel pretty comfortable with the way that we teach. And as you've probably already noticed, we talk really fast. Well, I talk so fast that he hasn't been able to say anything yet.
I'm just waiting for my moment. It's gonna be all right.
And so that is very engaging for some people, but for other learning styles, that might not be exactly the favorite thing for them, right? So you wanna find someone whose teaching style, not just their space, but also the way that they present material resonates for you and is easy for you to understand.
Which is also different from the material itself, right? So schools are gonna have a different focus depending on what the interests and the training and the experience of the teacher or teachers is. Some schools are gonna focus on clinical applications of plants, others on cultivation or harvesting or wildcrafting or shamanic work or any number of different things. But you gotta keep in mind that just because you found one that has the area of study or the area of focus that you're most interested in, there's still that other level of what's the personality that's conveying that to you, and how's that going to match with what you want and what you need.
Also, the style of the presentation is important. So in our school, because this is Boston and Boston is expensive, very few people can afford to be in a full-time program. But we have enough material for a full-time program. So the way that we counter that problem is that we have a 3-day weekend every month where we get together and we do a lot of very intensive work. And a lot of that is lecture because there's some stuff that we just need to tell you. But then through the other 27 days of the month, that's when you're doing a lot of experiential learning, a lot of reading, a lot of self-exploration and self-study. And we have an online forum to handle that, all of that extra stuff that people are doing. So that they can present that in the forum, all the rest of the students can see it, we can comment on it. Also, the other students can comment on it too. At our school, we don't believe that we're the only teachers. Everybody who comes into our school already knows a bunch of stuff, and a lot of it I don't know, right? So we wanna make sure that all of our students have time to talk to each other, because they're gonna teach each other things as well as us teaching things, right? And plus, they teach us things, which is really exciting. But so what that means is that in our program, there is a concentrated time that although we do go outside and we do medicine making and stuff like that, there is a lot of lecture. And then there's an expanded time of experiential learning with a lot of feedback coming. So if that is a program that resonates with you, that's really great. But what if what resonates with you is you want to be outside in the fields every single day with dirt under your fingernails, right? We're a clinical school. We like to have dirt under our fingernails too, but that's not our main focus of teaching. So you'd want to go find an apprenticeship that is really outdoors all the time if that's the style of learning that works for you. So it's really useful to take a little time to think about what do you want to learn? And how do you want to learn it, right? Also, it's really important to recognize that there's not just one game in town, right? There are lots of clinical schools to choose from. There are lots of hands in the dirt schools to choose from. There are shamanic schools to choose from. And if the school that you found that you're looking at right now doesn't resonate with you, don't think, oh, well, but this is the only school I know about, so I'll just suck it up and go to this one, even though it's not really what I want. Keep looking. There are multiple schools in this town, and there are now lots of schools that have online programs. So you can check that out as well. And online programs vary also. You do need to be super careful, right? Because a school is only as good as that school is. There's no such thing, and we're going to talk about this in a little bit. Actually, I think we're going to talk about it right now. There's no such thing as a certified herbalist in this country, right? So beware of schools that promise you a certification in herbalism. There is no such thing. We don't have a licensing body. We don't have a certifying body. So it's fine for a school to give you a certificate. We do that as well. But that certificate is really only useful as a documentation of the number of hours that you had in that program. That's useful because if later you want to join the AHG, the American Herbalist Guild, for example, you do need to document your hours of study. And so it's useful to have that, but it is not a certificate that gives you any particular rights, right? In this country, herbalists are not regulated in any way. As long as we're not pretending to be doctors, we're fine. So you can never do anything that makes you look like you are pretending to be a doctor. You don't play one on TV, there's no doctoring involved. But outside of that realm, we are unregulated, we're free to do whatever we want. You don't need a license or a certification to give you any particular right, and in fact, they're not available anyway, right? But where was I going with that? Lost it?
Things to watch out for, schools that might promise you such a thing.
Yes, yes. But online programs, that's what I was talking about. So it is very useful when you're looking at an online program to be a little bit more circumspect just because there's a lot of them out there. So again, with your online program, make sure that you can take a taster class. Make sure that you can check out what's involved in the program, exactly how many hours it is, what it covers. Is there going to be a forum where you can give feedback and ask questions? And that kind of stuff, because, you know, online, you're not right there in person, right? But regardless of it, of whether you're in person or whether you're online, trust your gut, right? Get some experience with that particular school, see what it's like, and then go with what your gut tells you. Do some research as well. It's important to research the person who's teaching or the people who are teaching. Some things that you can look for: have they written a book? And if they have, read it. Do they speak nationally at conferences? And if they have, can you get recordings of those and find out what that's about or what conferences they speak at? The different conferences all also have personalities. So that gives you some idea of like, oh, okay, this person speaks at, you know, the women's conference every year, and I am a doula, and I'm really interested in women's health, so that might be something that really works for me, for example. It's also really great to try to speak to students and find out what their experience was. So that's another way that you can get feedback about those teachers. It's really important that you have ahead of time very specific understanding of the schedule and commitments, right? You should know exactly what the cost is. There should not be any like hidden whatever, right? It should be very, very clear, very transparent. You should know what the time requirement is, how many hours of class there are, how many hours outside of class you're expected to do homework or is recommended for you to do homework. Because that's going to give you some information as well, right? If a class is expecting 5 to 10 hours of homework a week, then your first question is, does that fit into your schedule? But the second thing is, that's a fairly rigorous program. That's like taking a college class. And if that's what you're looking for, then that's what you want to see, right? You want to see that rigor expected. If you're looking for a program because, like, this is a hobby and you just want to have some fun with it, You might say, well, gee, I don't think I want to spend 5 to 10 hours a week doing homework. That doesn't actually sound like fun. So finding out what those requirements and expectations are ahead of time is really, really important. Good. Anything else you want to say there, baby?
I think we're pretty good on that one.
All right. Yeah. So let's talk about mentors a little bit, because you don't necessarily have to go to an herb school. Another option is that you can just find a mentor and find someone to work with personally on a one-on-one kind of situation. This might be, maybe you're really interested in herb farming, and so you meet Jenny from Muddy River Herbals, and you say, geez, you know, every Wednesday I can take off work at noon. Can I come and work with you and learn with you? And you think that she's fantastic, and so you know that your personality fits with hers. You know that what you want to be doing is growing plants, and you know that you want your hands in the dirt. And Jenny says, yeah, I really have this type of work that I need help with, and that's work that you want to be doing. Perfect. That's wonderful. When you're looking at a mentorship relationship, it's still all the same sorts of things that you would think about with an herb school, right? You still got to make sure that the personality is going to work for you, that there's not going to be some big, you know, clash of personalities. And you want to make sure that the person that you're going to mentor with is actually doing the stuff that you're interested in or that you think you're interested in. It's fine to do something for an amount of time and then say, wow, now I know more stuff about that, and I know that's not actually what I want to be doing, right? So that's also fine. It's great. One thing to be really careful there is that herbalists are not gurus. We don't do well if you put us on a pedestal. There is an inclination to do that with teachers, to be like, oh, well, my teacher, you know, like, no, you guys, I eat sugar. I do. I stay up too late and lots of other things. And I try to talk about that a lot with my students so that, especially because in our school, we also have a strong focus on food and on nutritional things that contribute to health or the lack thereof. And so a lot of students, you know, they hear, oh, well, she's gluten-free and dairy-free and she only eats pristine vegetables from the beautiful places of the beauty, whatever. And it's like, no, I need you to know that I do, in fact, eat sugar. You know, that does happen. So making sure that you are in a realistic relationship with your teacher, you're not thinking that your teacher is like, oh, perfect. And also making sure that your teacher's in a realistic relationship with themselves, that they don't think that they're a guru. That's very, very important. If they want you to put them on a pedestal, run. Run away. Never come back. All right. So then some self-study, right? Regardless of who you work with as a teacher, you also need to do self-study. It is actually completely acceptable to be a self-taught herbalist. You don't have to have a teacher. The plants are teachers, right? But you do need to study. So whether you go to an herb school or whether you have a mentor or whether you just buy every single herb book that's ever been, well, don't do that because some of them aren't very good. Self-study is a very, very important part of becoming an herbalist, mostly because you're the only one in your body, right? I can tell you what happens in my body, and I can tell you about my clients that I have a lot of experience with, but I can't tell you about your body. You're the only one who can tell you about your body.
Yeah, because she'll tell you that lobelia tastes good.
Oh, I will. I do love lobelia.
Crazy talk.
And I will tell you that that caffeine is a terrible idea.
And I won't tell you that tomorrow at 11 o'clock with my caffeine herbs class.
But if you also, just between the two of us here, we have very, very different bodies, right? Herbs that are fantastic in my body maybe aren't so effective in his body, or they're not exactly the thing that he needs, right? So no matter what I or any other teacher tells you, you don't actually know it until you know it in your body, right? You don't know it until you've worked with that plant. Sure, you may know how that plant works with lots of people, but until you've had it in you, you don't know, right?
We got these, like, stick on whiteboard paper in our school space so we could like write on all the walls because that's fun, right? And we put up there little slogans and things to remind us about what we care about and what we believe. And one of the bigger ones on the wall there is, you should never believe anything we say. And we want all of our students to see that right when they walk into the facility. The follow-up is, you have to feel it in your own body, right? So it's this kind of thing she's been talking about. We can give people ideas, we can point them in a direction, we can tell them our experience and what we've seen working with clients and teaching students over the years and all of that, but there's going to be a lot of variability. And there's always room to discover new things about plants, right? People have not exhausted the mysteries of ginger, right? We don't know everything there is to know about coffee, for that matter, right? So there's lots to learn and discover and apply. And if you start believing that this book has the whole story, or this herbalist, or this person, or this school has the whole story, then you're going to get bored and lose most of the fun of studying herbalism.
Yeah. So the other half of you should never believe anything we say is that everybody is trying to convince you that their way is right. Right? But the reality is, what's right for you is what's right for you, right? And what's right for your clients is what's right for your clients, if you're a person who sees clients, right? Or who wants to see clients. So again, like, unless you're really doing that self-study work, unless you're really thinking critically and going out and reading for yourself, in our school, we have a library of recordings. So we have thousands of hours of all kinds of herbalists who speak at conferences. Every time we go speak at a conference, we buy the entire conference. And then we make those available to our students, with here's this class by this herbalist, and here's their website, so you can go and get more of their stuff. But we feel that you should have lots and lots of teachers, right? Not just us, if you were at our school. Not just whoever the teacher is that you're working with, but lots and lots of teachers. And this is part of your self-study. Listening to or reading what lots of different herbalists have to say, and then thinking critically about that for yourself. How does that stand up with your own experience? Kind of like if you guys were to talk to 15 of my friends over the course of the last 42 years, you could maybe talk to my daughter, who would tell you some things about me, and you could talk to my husband, who would tell you some very nice things about me. And you could talk to some ex that I had in high school, who would maybe not tell you some great things about me. You could talk to my mom on a bad day from when I was like 15, and she would also not probably say very wonderful things about me at that time. So which of all these things are true? Right? Well, all of them. All of them are true, because they're all part of the complicated person that I am. And the good things and the less flattering things, they're all there. The same is true of plants, right? We can't just get the story about a plant from one person, because plants are complicated, awesome beings, right? And just like humans, they have different relationships with different people. And until you start to learn from lots of different people about those plants, you don't get the full, the full circle, the full story. So it's really, really important that when you are in your self-study phase of your education, which is every single day, right, that you are learning from what lots of other people have observed and what you in your own body have observed. When we work with the pharmacy students and also our apprentices, the pharmacy students do Herb of the Week and apprentices do Herb of the Month. And so we tell them, we want you to imbibe large quantities of whatever herb you're working with, unless it's an herb that's a low-dose herb, in which case we want you to imbibe small quantities of that herb. If it was lobelia, if it was lobelia and you were doing it as an Herb of the Week or an Herb of the Month, I would want you to puke once. That would be great, right? Just to know for sure that really does happen. But just once, that's totally enough. Lobelia is a plant that is excellent for anaphylaxis, fantastic for asthma attacks, really good for people who are giving up smoking, giving up nicotine, but in large doses, it is emetic. And that's a great thing. That's not like a negative part of it, right? Because sometimes puking is actually important. So that's beside the point here. So what we tell our students is we want you to consume large quantities of, or appropriate quantities of whatever plant it is you're working with. But then we tell them, and make some for your friends. And they'd be like, it's for school, you know? And if it's really bitter and nasty, just don't tell them. Just smile. But inflict it on your friends and find out what their reactions are, right? Because now you're getting information from other teachers and other people who have written books or have recorded lectures or whatever, information from your own body. Some of those books are going to be old, so you're getting information from traditional sources and information from your community, right? By giving it to your friends. Saying, hey, drink this. It's for school. Tell me how you feel. So that's a really good project. But in these ways, your self-study becomes very, very rich. And there's lots and lots of forms of input for you to start to get the whole picture, right? This is true even if you are, you're an herb farmer, which is something that I'm not actually fantastic at. I'm not really very good at it. So that's why I sort of say even if, it's because that's a thing that I'm not very good at. But if you are an herb farmer, you should still, if that's what you want to study, you should be doing that with lots of people too. Because this person may have this type of soil in their land, and they may need these types of soil amendments. And if you only study with that one person, you'll think, oh, well, anytime I grow lavender, I have to lime the soil or whatever. And then, but if you work with different people on different land with different soil, then you start to say, oh, I have a more round idea or a more complete idea of what types of soil this particular plant wants. I don't just think lavender needs lime, you know, whatever. I don't actually know if lavender needs lime because I'm not a very good herb grower.
Needs sandy soil.
Sandy soil?
That's why it doesn't grow in France.
Thank you.
Been to nowhere else for
you. All right. At any rate, the other thing about this is that you don't need to spend a lot of money. It's really warm in here. You don't need to spend a lot of money on your education. If you're going to engage with a teacher or a school, obviously, you know, pay a fair price. But if you don't have a lot of money and you still want to learn to be an herbalist, there are so many free and low-cost options out there. There are lots of things just on YouTube that you can check out. There's a website, herbmentor.com, which is pretty cool and is not too expensive. They have like a monthly plan. They have a particular style, and it's only that one style, so then you still need lots of other input. But between that and stuff that you can do on YouTube or various herbalists' free things, there are lots of conferences that happen all through the summer, spring, and fall, all across the country. And those conferences usually are around $300 to attend, plus your transportation to get there and maybe your lodging and whatever else. That's kind of expensive. But they sell recordings of the entire conference, usually for more like $100. So you can actually get a recording of every single thing that happened at that conference for usually between $100 and sometimes $200, which is still a lot of money, but it's a lot of hours of information, and it's way cheaper than actually attending the conference. So that's another thing that might be an option for you for low-cost stuff so that you can get input.
We do have a list of some resources that we found to be both high quality and reliable information on our website. It's commonwealthherbs.com/resources. So check that out.
All right. And then there's something to be said for teaching, right? If you can teach something, you know you really understand it, right? So, we definitely advocate that people start teaching as soon as they feel comfortable doing that. If you're a person who doesn't love standing in front of people, that doesn't mean that you can't teach. You can just invite your friends over for a barbecue and put some herbs on the fish that you're grilling and then talk to them about those herbs, right? Talk to them about why those herbs are really cool and delicious. Teaching doesn't have to look like this. It doesn't have to look like owning your own school. Teaching can be just hanging out with your friends, with I don't know, Tazo, you know, it could be whatever. You know, a long time before I was a full-time herbalist, I was a software engineer. And I had a filing cabinet next to my desk that had zero files in it, but did have like all kinds of herbs in there. And I was the one that, you know, oh, I have a hungover from, you know, last night, and I have a headache, and don't you have any herbs in that filing cabinet of yours? Oh, yes, I do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's another way to be a teacher, right? Just in individual situations. But as soon as you start to feel comfortable with some knowledge, then start sharing it. Because when you start sharing it, and then somebody asks a question, you say, oh dear, I don't actually know the answer to that question. Let me find that out for you, right? Not knowing the answer doesn't mean that you're not an herbalist. It just means that there's more exciting research to be done. So that is a really great way. Presenting information, regardless of how informal it is a great way to help you solidify what you know and help push your boundaries to increase your knowledge, right? One thing to think about, though, is that that there is sort of a balance. You don't want to take your first 9-month apprenticeship and at the end of that decide that you're going to start teaching a 9-month apprenticeship, right? We have a mentor, Paul Bergner, who I highly recommend. He has excellent CDs of recorded classes available, and I just can't say enough about how excellent they are. His name was Paul Bergner, if you wanted that again. One thing that he loves to teach at conferences is a class called How to Be a Master Herbalist in 30 Years or More. It takes a long time. I've been doing this for 18 years, I guess now, 19 years maybe, and I'm just starting to feel like I have a handle on it. You know, I'm just starting to feel like I might know a thing or two. So watch for me to fall on my face any minute now. It takes a lot. It's complicated. Humans are complicated. Plants are complicated. Complicated beings interacting with each other. It's complicated. It's amazingly beautiful, but it's complicated. So there's sort of a balance. Teach what you know. When there's something you don't know, that's okay. Just say, hey, I don't know that yet. Let's go find out together. Hey, I don't know that yet. I'm so excited to research it and come back and let you know what I find, right? Not knowing doesn't mean you're not an herbalist, right? But it's important also not to pretend like you know some things that you don't, because you feel like in order to be an herbalist, you must have some sort of level of... That's a real danger that we've gotten into... What danger? That's a problem that we've gotten into in mainstream medicine right now, right? Doctors are expected to be experts. They're expected to know all the answers. A person can't know all the answers, especially about a body they're not even in, right? And so when we take that model and we put it on top of herbalists and expect, well, a doctor's supposed to know all the answers, I expect that in order to be an herbalist, you know all the answers too. That's not the paradigm, right? The paradigm is, I know some things and I'm going to share them with you and I'm really excited about that. And when we find gaps or we find questions, then we have the exciting opportunity to learn more. Did you want to add to that?
I'm good.
Wow.
I'm all set, yeah.
Some fun places that you can reach out to as you start to know things. You could talk to your local gardeners club. Maybe there are some Weston A. Price chapters or some paleo groups or whatever that might want to learn about herbs as food. Mushroom hunters. You can lead herb walks at local farms or at the park. You can just go to the local cafe. And please ask me before you do this, but just put a little sign on the table that says, you know, free herbal discussion or whatever, and just have your cup of tea and anybody can sit down with you and talk about herbs for a while, right? It's a great way to help you find your sort of boundaries, help you find the things that you do very well, the places where you still have questions, and also gets the word out in the community that, oh, this is a person who knows some things about plants. Cool. All right, some very specific skills that are really useful to cultivate. One is your materia medica. It's really great to know 9 plants upside, really well. Inside, outside, upside down, I think that's the phrase. To know everything you can know about a small number of plants, that's fantastic. It's also great to know a few things about a large number of plants, right? But regardless of what you do, it's important to do it every day, right? Whatever style you have. Phyllis Light is an herbalist in Alabama, and her father was an herbalist, and he practiced with one plant. One plant. His whole life, he used one plant. Until he was, like, I think 70 years old, and his brother sent him an aloe vera plant. And then he had two plants. Right? But one plant, ginseng, American ginseng. Yep. Alabama. So there's something to be said for that style of practice. Like, just have 5 or 9 herbs that you know really, really well, every aspect of those plants. There's something to be said for knowing a wide array of plants, but the wider your array of plants, of course, the less deep you will know them until you've been doing this for a really long time. And it's amazing because just like a person, just like your husband even, you can be married for a good long time and then be like, hey, I never heard that story before, right? Because that's just the way it is. And that's true with plants also. For a long time now, my favorite plant has been chamomile. And, you know, it's sort of like, chamomile, really? Like, you're an herbalist. You've been an herbalist forever. Isn't it something more exotic that, no, chamomile. There's always more to learn.
Well, for instance, how many of you have used chamomile as tincture? Wait, come on.
Used it as what?
Use chamomile as a tincture?
In alcohol.
Okay, 2, 3. Yeah, you guys. Chamomile tincture?
Whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a whole new world. It's a whole new world.
Yeah. Really good.
So it's really important. One way that you can do this is you can get a really good Materia Medica book. I happen to like the Earthwise Herbal by Matt Wood, but there's lots of great ones out there. Keep it next to your bed and read an herb a night. You know, every night before you go to bed, just read an herb, right? And think about that. And of course, that's going to excite you and inspire you to go and do things with that plant then. You can maintain an herb of the week or an herb of the month practice for your whole life, right? You can just say, okay, well, this month I'm really going to work with chamomile. And I'm going to have some chamomile every single day. I'm going to have a lot of chamomile every day. I'm going to find out what happens if I drink a ton of chamomile right before a really important business meeting. Right? You might not. Actually, you might not. You'd be surprised. But what happens in your body if you do that? What happens if you drink a ton of chamomile right before bed? Well, you'll probably get up and pee at night. But, but you know, how does all that work? What happens if you mix chamomile with ginger? Oh, definitely try that. So all these different things, and when you really set the intention that this month I am going to work intimately, deeply with this one plant, sure, that you may also have other plants that happen, because the more you're an herbalist, the more that there are just plants at every meal and plants in between meals and just plants all the time. But the more that you find out just how that plant interacts with you, with your friends, with whatever it is you're cooking for dinner tonight. And so that's a really excellent exercise. You could even have an herb of the year. It's okay. You could spend an entire year working intimately with one. How many years have I worked intimately with my husband? Right? And there are still things I don't know. And there are still ways in which we're changing and growing together. So you actually can do that even with a plant. And I totally recommend it, no matter how you are educating yourself in other ways. Definitely recommend, have an herb of the time period, right? Whether it's a week, a month, a year, whatever. have an herb that you're working with all the time.
Yeah. And about Materia Medica, I mean, you can just pick up a book and go through it in alphabetical order. That's fine. You might also choose to prioritize herbs that are, there's a term, polycrest, which means they're used for lots and lots of different problems. So ginger would fit that role, chamomile, catnip, peppermint, you know, a lot of the ones that are kind of the big names in the herbal world. You might also look at herbs that are local to you and try to identify every plant on your walk from home to wherever you work at, right? And be able to know all of them and to know how they're used for medicine now, how they were in the past, and things like that, right?
This is a great game to play if you have kids, by the way.
Yeah.
It's very, very good. If you're walking anywhere with a child, plant ID is really...
It's great if you have like some route that you take habitually and you can see all the plants along there and start to watch them and be like, now, okay, I know where there's this really big bush of bittersweet nightshade, and I know where there's a little patch of Malva neglecta, And then, you know, like, you just get familiar with them and you see them grow and change over the years, and now you start to feel a little more connected to the ground itself. It's always nice.
Even in the city, there's that. The other side of this is sensory integration, right? Especially because we're city herbalists. I'm making an assumption that you guys all live in town. Maybe you don't. But especially as city herbalists, sensory integration is really, really important. So that is the development of, and the sort of attuning of, all of your senses that are not on the internet, right? This is difficult to do because there are people talking in the hallway and there's electricity buzzing in wherever it's buzzing, and there's all sorts of other things going on, and there's schedules and meetings and work and all the things that have to be done, and the TV is noisy and whatever else. It's hard to do. So if you need to get out of the city to do it, do that. By the way, the last weekend in July, we have a silent retreat on our new school land in Royalston. There's information about it on our website, so check that out. Very good for sensory integration. But whatever you can do to start honing that is really, really important. So what are some things you can do? You can have a sit spot that you visit, ideally every day, but maybe it's 3 times a week or something. And that sit spot does not have to be in beautiful, pristine nature that you drove an hour to get to, right? In fact, it would be better if you sat with a scraggly old dandelion in your backyard that was mostly dirt, and like your upstairs neighbor's dog poop. It would be better to do that and actually do it on a regular basis than it would be to go out to some beautiful place, but you're not really gonna do it very often. And part of the reason is because being in relationship with a very specific area and with a very specific plant in that area gives you a different perspective. You start to notice what bugs live with that plant. That's important. Who pollinates that plant? How does that plant grow? What type of soil is it growing in? Being with a dandelion in the muddy, dirty, dog poopy backyard of your Somerville apartment tells you a lot about dandelion, right? And about what dandelion can grow through and the tenaciousness of that plant. The Arboretum is fortunately not that far away. And so if you're able to go to someplace like the Arboretum, that's really fantastic, but your backyard will totally suffice. And you don't even need to have the very most perfectest plant either. You can just pick whoever's in your backyard. We had, before I had learned Japanese barberry, we moved into an apartment in Brighton, and there's a Japanese barberry growing in the backyard, and I was so interested in this shrub, and it would have these little berries, and I was like, oh, this is the coolest shrub. And then I learned, hey, that's Japanese barberry, right? So it's okay to sit with a plant even if you don't know who it is, right? You can learn a lot about that plant even if you don't know the human name, even if you don't look it up in human books. Right? You will still learn lots and lots of stuff about that plant. Eventually you will find out, and then you'll be like, hey, I know you, right? So that's really cool. And so that's an excellent way. We really recommend at least 20 minutes in a spot, because 20 minutes is how long it takes for the rest of the world to come back to its baseline. In the city, maybe that goes a little faster, but if you go into the woods, you know, you're making human noises and the animals all get quiet and the birds stop singing and whatever. And you sit down and you just be still for 20 minutes and stuff starts up again. They decide, oh, well, you're just sitting there. I don't have to be worried, right? And so the things that you will see after 20 minutes are different than the things that you will see before 20 minutes. So that's sort of a magic number right there. It's also really good to do this in all weather. Do it in the rain, do it in the snow, right? Do it in the beautiful weather, do it all the time. Because all those things are important. You learn a lot about a plant when you learn what kind of water happens with it. What happens in that plant's area with water when it rains, right? Does it pool up? Does it run off? Does it drain in quickly? All that kind of stuff. Yes. All of those awesome things. There's many more suggestions in the handout that you can get at commonwealthherbs.com/herbstock. But I'm realizing that I need to start talking even faster.
We have till 3:30.
Yep.
Good. Okay, cool.
All right. So that's some stuff about education and skills, right? Great. So now you've got education, you've got some skills. How do you make it official? Right? This culture is very enamored of official, right? Your parents want to be able to see your beautiful degree from the beautiful places. They want, you know, like your friends are like, oh, well, did you... Herbalism is not official, right? So again, we are not licensed, we are not regulated. We think that's a really good thing, me and Rin. We like that. We like that on one hand because yes, we can't take insurance. And a lot of people say, oh, well, wouldn't it be better if herbalists could take insurance? I think no, right? Because then you get oversight by insurance companies and they're having enough trouble overseeing mainstream medicine. Herbalism is so much more complicated, that would not go well, right? But also, everybody speaks a different language. Everybody practices in a different way. There's no way that an insurance company can regulate how I might work with one person and how you might work with a totally different person, right? There's so many different styles involved. We could both be doing very good, competent, responsible herbalism, and it might look very, very different. So it would be extremely difficult to regulate. But also, it's not worth it. Once we start talking about medicine for profit, we end up with the current mainstream system where people are required to chart their productivity. It's not okay anymore to sit with a patient for hours and hours because that was the right thing to do for that patient, right? Instead, you have to like check off the whatever. Doctors are required to see something like 13, primary care physicians, 13 patients a day just to stay in their practice, right? Like that's, how can you work with 13 people in one day and have meaningful relationships with those people, right? So that's what happens when we let money into the practice of healthcare. So from that perspective, I'm very happy to have money not be playing a role. Sure, I do need to eat, but herbalists find ways to deal with that. For us, we have a student clinic, so, If a client is willing to allow a student to observe, then that appointment becomes pay whatever you can that day, right? We also have free clinic one weekend a month where it's completely, totally free, and that also involves our students. So that's a way for us that we can subsidize doing low-income work and even no-income work. And then, of course, we have clients who go ahead and pay the whole fee, and they do that knowing that they're also helping to subsidize people who are not able to do that right now. So there are ways to get around the affordability issue that don't involve insurance, and I would rather keep it that way because that way we also are not told how we have to spend our time, and if I need to spend an entire day with a family who's dealing with some food allergies and a young baby, then I'm able to do that, right? Again, also with certification, you know, it's the certificate that you get is worth the paper that it's printed on and the reputation of the school that you got it from. That's about it, right? So make sure that the paper's really nice and that the school has integrity. All right. Another thing around licensure is that in order to regulate herbalists, they would need to prove that herbs are dangerous, right?
We license dangerous things like driving a car or performing surgery, right? Things that you can kill yourself or other people in the course of, right? Herbalism is not dangerous in this way. Even if you take the most pessimistic view of it and you fold in not just like herbalists giving herbs to people, but somebody going into a random store or a random internet retailer and buying some weird supplement. Even at that, you'll see maybe one or maybe no people dying in the course of a year as a result of these sorts of actions. So this isn't exactly a whoever kills the fewest people wins kind of a game, but as herbalists, we do feel pretty good that we're really on the high end of that scale, all right? I've looked for cases of an herbalist being brought to court for harming a client, right? And in the course of looking at that, I found a lot of things about herbalists and other sort of like alternative practitioners giving people bad advice, like, nah, you should just stop chemo, you should not take that drug anymore, whatever. This is bad advice, don't give that to your clients, and if your herbalist does, then send them to me. No, I'll take care of it. But I haven't found any cases of somebody like, I gave you plants, you got sick or died, and now you're in big trouble in the courts. Unless you go back to, what is it, 1883?
38?
Oh man, I used to know this one off the top of my head. Have you guys heard of Samuel Thompson? So he was an herbalist, kind of one of the founding herbalists of the American tradition. He practiced in the 1800s, and he made a lot of enemies amongst the...
1838, I'm pretty sure. He was early 1800s,
Anyway, he got brought to court one time because a patient of his had died after he had seen them, and he was accused of causing this through the administration of lobelia. Got his favorite plant.
I love lobelia. I have an anaphylactic allergy, and I use lobelia instead of an EpiPen. That's appropriate for my body. I wouldn't necessarily tell everyone to run out and throw away their EpiPens, but if you're in a position to experiment and that feels right to you, and you are holding your EpiPen at the ready just in case, then you know there are safe ways to do that experiment and find out if this is the right thing for you. But for me, that it does work very well. So I do love lobelia. It keeps me alive.
Yeah, but so you know, Thompson was accused of killing Ezra Lovett by administering lobelia to him, and eventually, what happened in that case was that the judge threw it out. He was like, "You have not presented any good evidence. This is nonsense. You people are full of ridiculous. Go away from here forever." This wasn't the end of Thompson's troubles. He had a whole lot of other interesting engagements with the law and other doctors and whatever else during the course of his life.
He was a bit of a rebel.
Yeah. But that's it. That's the last time that I can find an herbalist actually being brought to court for causing harm. So if somebody was to propose to you, no, it would be a good idea for us to choose to have a licensing body formed, then recognize that in the course of developing that and proposing that and finding the money for that on a state or a national scale, they would be sort of de facto declaring that this is a dangerous practice. And I don't agree with that on any level.
The other outcome of that would mean that herbs would become regulated and people wouldn't have access to herbs anymore.
About the EU. We can see what that looks like if we look at the United Kingdom and the European Union right now. Because there is better integration of, I would say, phytotherapy more than herbalism into conventional medical practice, but... and there is a National Institute of Medical Herbalists in England and so on, and that's all well and good, but they're very restricted in the way that they're allowed to practice. For instance, they're not in all cases allowed to formulate for individual clients. They are required to only use formulas or individual herbs that are in the National Pharmacopoeia. So, I mean, even at that level, I would feel completely hamstrung trying to work with an individual person. So there are certainly other layers to that trouble as well. There's lots of herbs that are restricted from commerce, even if they're completely safe. There's many issues with the way that goes down. So it would not just be as simple as, no, then you'll get to go and work in the hospital and take insurance or whatever. It's kind of a trap, you know? Like, there's some lure to that, but the downsides are really large. And a lot of the problems that would emerge from that would be cutting down on the diversity of practice that we have in the U.S., I mean, even at this conference, you've got people teaching from an Ayurvedic perspective, TCM, Western herbalism, energetic herbalism, whatever else. And that's one of the strengths of the way that herbalism is taught and practiced in America today, is that we have lots of different voices speaking together.
Another point to be made there is that it isn't to say that there are no dangerous herbs, right? Of course there are, right? It isn't to say that there are no herbs that are without side effects. Nothing has side effects. Everything just has effects, you know, whatever. We like some of them, and we don't like others, and the ones we don't like, we call them side effects, but really there's just effects. There are lots of plants that are very, very strong and that should be used with caution, right? So I don't want to imply that just because we think that licensure is neither desirable nor necessary means that there's no possible way to hurt somebody with plants. You can do that. You can hurt somebody with plants. You probably won't kill them. But you can hurt someone, and in fact, any herbalist who's been in practice for a while has a story of, you know, oops. Hopefully they did it to themselves, but, you know, like, I studied with Rosemary Gladstar, was my first teacher, and her favorite story is when there was a little too much mustard in the mustard plaster and ended up burning the person's chest, you know. When, so, you know, even a totally famous, one of the most famous herbalists in the country definitely has made mistakes and accidentally hurt somebody with plants, right? But that's not the same as saying that they are so dangerous as to be required to be restricted and licensed, right? We can be responsible for ourselves. We can be responsible for the things that we would like to try in our bodies, right? There was something else I wanted to say there. It also doesn't mean that there's no crappy herbalists out there, right? There are. There's crappy herbalists out there. But I would rather that a person who comes to work with me knows that I am unregulated and that there may be crappy herbalists out there, because that means that they need to be responsible for engaging their brain and being responsible for their own health. If you walk into a doctor's office, you're just trusting that that doctor is a good doctor. Well, maybe you're not. But most people just walk in and whatever doc says, that's what you do, right? Now, that doctor might be fantastic, but he might not, because 50% of all doctors graduated in the bottom half of their class, right? So we want to be sure that people understand that they are the ones responsible for their health. We say it all the time in this culture, right? Oh, well, my doctor has me on blah, blah, blah. Does he show up every morning and force that pill down your throat? No, you have you on that. Your doctor suggested it and you agreed to it. But because there's a piece of paper on his wall that says he's official, we don't take responsibility for that. When a person comes to work with me, there's no piece of paper on the wall. So they need to know for themselves that the last thing, the last check in that action is their own decision about whether or not they think it's a good idea. I can educate, I can motivate, I can inspire, I can do lots and lots of things. And I can do them all legally. But I'm not a doctor, I don't want to be a doctor. I don't want to be licensed, because I want the person to retain the authority for themselves over their own body. All right, so in that regard, scope of practice. Very first, obviously, do no harm, right? Don't hurt the people you're working with, preferably. And also informed disclosure, right? So when you're first starting out with things, and it doesn't matter what it is, you've probably had this experience at some point. You're first starting out with whatever you're first starting out with, and there's that nervous feeling inside. Oh, will I be accepted? Oh, am I actually good enough? Will people believe me? And so that yields that desire to say, oh, well, I know all the things, right? And maybe you have had this experience at some point. And maybe it was with something simple like, I don't know, calculus or whatever. And then you found out that, oh, I didn't actually know all the things, right? It was your first day as a tutor. And then you were like, yes, 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 no. And you were like, boy, I don't know if I can do this. Ah, I know everything. Because you're trying to compensate for that sort of questioning inside yourself. Not safe to do as an herbalist, right? First off, everybody is asking themselves those questions. Every single person, me, every single time I sit down with a client. Right? After 18 or 19 years, Paul Bergner, after more than 30 years, every time he sits down with a client, he's thinking, I'm not sure I'm good enough for this, right? I'm not sure I know enough to do what I need to do right now. That's okay. So if we tell you now that we still feel this way, then when you start feeling this way, you'll be like, well, all right, well, everybody feels this way. This is okay. And so the next thing is, instead of convincing yourself that you're fantastic, just say, well, I know what I know, and I know what I don't know. And if a person has something I don't know, no problem. I'll say, I don't know, but I'll find out for you, right? Let me go do some research. Let's experiment and find out together. This is one of the strongest skills that you can develop as an herbalist, right? It's not just humility, it's also just straight up reality. Because I can't know what's happening in your body. You're the only one in your body. You're the only one who knows. I can know some things. I can know lots of things. but you're the only one who really knows what's in your body. And the wonderful thing about that is, as you work as an herbalist, you don't have to know everything, right? Because the bottom line is, they're the only ones who know. You can suggest lots of things. They're the only ones who are gonna know for real if it's right or not. So you just take that pressure right off yourself and just say, well, hey, I know these things. I'll tell you, these are the things I know. I will give you an informed disclosure or whatever. This is what I know. This is what I don't know. And I'm speaking here from a clinical perspective, but that's true as a cultivator, as a whatever else, right? If you're going to go get a job on an herb farm or in a botanical garden, well, hey, these are the things I know. There's some things I don't know, and that's cool. I'll find out, whatever they are. People worry about insurance a lot. If you're going to work as an herbalist, we generally think that it's not very necessary. We felt that way for a long time, and then one of our third-year students decided that she really needed to get insurance to feel comfortable doing the work. So she went to an insurance agency, and the person who worked there said, well, I'll write you the insurance, but you don't really need it. This is never going to come up. At that point, the person said, oh, well, all right then, I guess. Like, if an insurance agent says, I shouldn't actually sell you this, you don't need it, then probably you don't need it, right? So that's how we feel about it. Everybody kind of makes their own decisions. You can get insurance that basically, you can get insurance that says if somebody slips and stabs themselves with a pitchfork on your property while you're doing an herb gardening workshop, that you won't be held accountable. Or you can get insurance that says, if you've taught something and the person didn't learn it well and then they accidentally went and had poison hemlock instead of Queen Anne's lace, then water hemlock, you know, whatever, then, you know, you're not responsible for that. But it's really not necessary. What is important is to just be very, very transparent, right? I am not a doctor, right at the top. I'm not a doctor. I am a farmer, I am a gardener, I am a health educator, I am a whatever, I'm not a doctor, right? And just to be very transparent with what you know, what you don't know. Even with your friends. Hey, I've been studying some stuff about plants. You could try it out and we could find out how it works for you. This worked really great for me. Let's see how it works for you. Right? You wanna talk about health freedom X?
Yeah, okay, so the kind of thing she was describing in your informed disclosure practices there, that will protect you in the vast majority of the cases in case somebody was dissatisfied with the way you practiced with them or maybe, you know, a relative or whatever else. There have been cases like this that have been brought up and herbalists have successfully been able to defend themselves. There's another way that this can be strengthened or it can be basically enshrined in law. It's sort of a way to take existing judicial precedent and then say like, okay, we're just gonna lay it out and make this explicit, right? So that's called a Health Freedom Act. And a good place for information on this in the national level is the National Health Freedom Coalition. Here in Massachusetts, we have, the website is hfama.org. It's Health Freedom Action, Massachusetts. And so what we're trying to do is get a law passed here in Massachusetts. There are existing ones in 11 other states right now, including Rhode Island, I think is the only other New England state that has one. But with these laws, they're also sometimes referred to as a safe harbor law. And this isn't just for herbalists. This is also for homeopaths and for people doing body work that's not covered under massage licensing and whatever else.
Susie and tickle therapy.
Right, whatever you've got, yeah. So if you're an unlicensed practitioner and you're doing something that is not killing hundreds of people a year and is not impinging on medical practice or the practices of any other licensed group, then a law like this says, okay, as long as you declare to your clients that you're not a doctor, that this is your training and your experience, that these are the kinds of expectations they should have from your interaction, and make it clear that you're operating under these auspices, then no one can accuse you of practicing medicine without a license, which, as I mentioned before, is the thing that you, if you were to get in trouble as a practicing herbalist, that would be how, right? It would be that somebody, mistook you for a doctor or asked you if you could treat their IBS or that you could cure their cancer or whatever else, if you agree to something like that, then you are, according to the law, you are now practicing medicine, all right? So you need to be on guard about certain terms, right? You don't use treat, cure, diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any named medical condition, right? As herbalists, sometimes we start to feel a little annoyed about that. We're like, sure, I can do this, I can take care of you, or whatever. But what we've kind of come around to is to look at it from another perspective and say, you know what, I'm not really so interested in the medical condition, because that's like a nominative entity that doesn't really have strong, like, ontological reality here. Like, it's
arbitrary, right? If we say diabetes, that's not a thing. That's just our word to describe something that we've observed. We could use a different word for it.
Yeah.
It's just a word.
So instead of trying to treat medical conditions, my work as an herbalist is to help people become more vital, become more balanced, right? And there's lots of different ways that we can attain that. So I don't use that kind of language on the one hand, because if I do, then I'm breaking the law, and I don't like to do that, unless it's really worth it. But also because I want the shape of our relation to be different, right? If you look at the definition of the practice of medicine in this state, it includes things like assumes responsibility and encourages the reliance of the person upon your expertise. That's not something I want to do, right? I want to share my expertise and my experience with people, but I don't want to encourage their reliance upon me. Right? I don't want to enter into that relationship. And so the way I use my words and the way that I use my intention and the way I talk to the person about what we're going to do together, it's pretty far removed from medicine as such. A question back there?
Will you ever recommend people to go back to their doctor and get certain tests, which then you can use to appropriately recommend?
Sometimes I might. That would fall under sharing information or sharing resources, right? So most of the work we do as herbalists, it's basically education. You know, and on our informed disclosure, we lay that right out and say, like, this is pretty much going to be a personalized class for whatever you're interested in, right? So yeah, sometimes we will refer back to a medical practitioner. We'll also do that if they have some indicators that there's something really serious on, and they should at least discover whether they do have diabetes or they do have cancer or whatever else going on, right? So that is a wise practice, and you know, as we go through clinical training, we'll be like, okay, so here's some red flags, here's some things that somebody should go and get a blood panel done or whatever else, right? And it's useful to be able to collaborate with people in conventional medicine, right? Because they have tools that I don't have, right? I can see what's going on somebody's face and their tongue and their pulse and this and that, but I don't have a real, like, good x-ray vision going on yet. I'm working on it, you know, but, like, the size of your kidney stone, I don't know. I'm not really there between, like, 1 and 3 millimeters yet. I'll get there, right? But anyway, so the Health Freedom Act, right, it's designed to take that existing common law precedent and just say, like, make it explicit and give people some standards of informed disclosure so that if you adhere to that, you're all set, right, and you're good. So this is all about clinical practice. There's a whole other set of considerations you have to get if you want to start making medicine products and selling them.
And that is referred to as GMP, which is Good Manufacturing Practices. And it seems, when you start off, extraordinarily intimidating. Well, that's not altogether an accident. If there are fewer people in the marketplace, there are fewer people to regulate. And so this sort of pattern happens a lot with the government. We can make stuff really hard and expensive, and then there will be fewer people doing it, and then we don't have to regulate so many of them, right? So yes, the GMP guidelines that make it legal for you to sell your product at Whole Foods, for example, they're a little scary, but they're not impossible. We highly recommend a class by Suchil Kaufman at thehumanpath.org. It is an online class. It's called The Apothecarist, and it goes through not just medicine making, but how do you legally label those medicines? How do you fill out all the different forms that need to be filled out so that you can legally produce them and sell them in the public sphere? What are the different things you need to track, and how do you do that? And she does a fantastic job of demystifying and de-scarifying this process, right? So if you're interested in making products and selling them, this is a really, really good way to get that information down solid. You may have heard people say something like, oh, well, you'll need hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of equipment in order to be legally compliant to sell your products. That's not actually true. So,
and you can talk to Kathy upstairs at Herbal Revolution about this, because she's gone through that process, and probably some of the other retailers here as well.
Yeah, but Kathy sells in Whole Foods, and so she definitely knows all about it. In fact, her table is right next to ours, so you can find her that way. You know, it's not until you get really, really big that you start needing the hundreds of thousands of dollars part of this equation. So people like Urban Moonshine, who are really, really big, okay, they've gotten to a scale where now they do need some scientific equipment to do some parts of their tracking for their production. But if you're going to be on this sort of a scale, or if you just want to sell stuff at Cambridge Naturals or at your local farmers market, then really the stuff that you need to do to be legal is not going to cost a whole lot of money. It will be a little bit obnoxious, and it will take up some time, and you'll need to do some tracking and keep some paperwork. But in that apothecarist class, thehumanpath.org, Suchil goes through every single form you need. She gives you all the forms, teaches you how to fill them out, then you fill them out for homework, then you bring them back and we go over it and figure out what things are right and wrong and whatever. Teaches you exactly what you can and can't put on a label, all that kind of stuff. And as long as you are doing those things, then you're gonna be okay. So don't let the sound of that process scare you out of the idea of making herbal products, because lots of people need herbal things, right? And they don't all have time to make it themselves. So they want you to make it for them. And the paperwork is a pain in the butt, but it's not that scary once you get it all worked out. So definitely check that out. Okay, good. So now we've gone through all this stuff. How do you make a living, right? Because that's part of the important part here. The first thing is, on one hand, there are lots of job prospects for herbalists today. On the other hand, being self-employed is being self-employed, right? And so I feel like there's kind of been a generation gap around self-employment, because for a long time, lots of people were self-employed, and then there was like this sort of generation or generation and a half where everybody just goes to work in offices or goes to work in whatever and they just get a paycheck. So there's kind of a disconnect from personal experience with what it's like to be in business for yourself. I will tell you, it's a lot of work. It's a whole lot of work. And you do cobble it together. You are not going to get a paycheck every week. If you're in business for yourself, you're going to get some money here, some money there, and you're going to just sort of make it work. You are definitely not going to get paid a fair wage for the number of hours that you work. And everyone will tell you, but that's okay because you love it. Well, you do love it, but you also work real hard, and it's kind of, you know, a trade-off. So that's an important thing to know going into it. You'll work real hard, you'll work way more hours than you get paid for, but you will love it, so it's worth it. But there are even ways that you can do it with a paycheck, right? You can, of course, go to Whole Foods and manage the health and body section, right? You can work at someplace like Cambridge Naturals. Those things are totally great ways to use an herbal education. If you already have some sort of a practice, maybe you're a massage therapist or an acupuncturist or something else, you can incorporate it into a practice you already have. Or you can build your own. So whether that is you want to go out and make a bunch of products, whether you want to become a clinical herbalist, whether you want to go and become a farmer, the very first piece of advice we can tell you is don't quit your day job, right? Because you need to pay the bills, and you need to have confidence that that is being taken care of. There is a parable, it's some Middle Eastern or Eastern kind of teaching. I should really find out where exactly this comes from, but it's beautiful and I love it. And so there was, you know, the holy person and all of that holy person's attendants, you know, who were learning from him. And there was a meal being served, and the holy person served his own bowl first. Then he went and he took all the rest of the food and he served everyone else. And afterwards, his students came to him and said, what are you doing? Like, how rude. Why did you serve yourself first? You're supposed to serve yourself last, right? And the teacher said, well, if I serve myself last, then every spoonful that I give out, I'm going to be worried there won't be one for me. If I serve myself first, then I can give freely everything else that's left, right? Whoa. Whoa. You just meditate on that every morning, right? So if you have a day job and you're like, boy, I'm so sick of this office. All I want to do is play with plants all day. That's great. And more power to you. But keep the office job for a while, because that way you know your bills will be paid. You don't have to be afraid that there's not going to be enough for you. Fear will make you make bad decisions, right? It will make you cut corners. It will make you not happy in what you're doing. So knowing that the bills are paid, even if you're doing a job you don't like to pay them, gives you the freedom to do the things that you want to do. We typically tell our students to transition slowly. So first we'll say, we'll talk to your boss and ask for a 4-day week instead of a 5-day work week, right? And now you have at least one whole day, but really three, because you're gonna work every day anyway as an herbalist, so go ahead and work the weekends, it's fine. So now you have 3 days a week that you get to be an herbalist, whatever kind of herbalist you wanna be, and 4 days a week that you're paying your bills, right? And then slowly, you might go to 3 days a week at your office job and 4 days a week as an herbalist, and eventually you might get to a place where your herbalism is stable enough that you, and you've kind of like gotten some money saved aside as well, that now you can cut the cord and quit the day job, and now, and that might take years, right? You might also find that being an herbalist on Tuesdays is enough, right? You might not actually hate your day job, but you just really love plants, and so you're a Tuesday herbalist, right? On Tuesdays, you go and you work at the local food shelter or food pantry, teaching people how to incorporate herbs into their rice and beans so that they can increase the nutritional content of what they're eating, right? And all the rest of the days, you keep your job because it isn't that bad. You don't actually hate it. You don't actually ever have to quit your day job. But if you plan to, do it slow. Do it with a bit of a safety net. At some point, you have to take the leap. But keep that safety net there as long as you possibly can, because that's going to make sure that you can pay your bills, right? The big key here is do not go into debt, right? Herbalism does not pay well. You can survive, but you will not be rich. So don't go into debt. If you're not in debt, you're free. If you're in debt, you're never free, right? You're always going to be depending on some money. And a lot of times, you think there's going to be money there, and it's not, right? So that's just a reality anytime that you're self-employed, no matter what the self-employment is. And it doesn't have anything to do specifically with herbalism. But herbalism is medicine of the people. We do, no matter what type of herbalist you are, we absolutely do a lot of low-income work. So there's a lot of work that you might want to do that just simply doesn't have any dollars attached to it. So if you don't get into debt, you're free to do that, right? All you have to do is cover your current expenses, and all the rest of the time that you have, you're free to give freely to whoever needs it, right? So in case I haven't mentioned it yet, don't go into debt. Do not write a business plan. I mean, it's okay if you want to do that, but don't take it to a bank to get a loan, right? Don't take out a loan so that you can open up an office space. Sublet from somebody else. Just rent their office for Tuesday mornings. In fact, in Somerville, there's a new wellness center, Union Wellness Center,
yeah.
Right? And we just learned about it today. It's actually a friend of ours. Has converted this excellent old building into many therapist rooms, and they schedule even by the half day. So you could literally just rent Tuesday mornings in a space, right? And that may be very cost effective because maybe you can see two clients every Tuesday morning, but the first half of the first client covered the cost of that space.
It might also be that, you know, you've got a really nice living room, or you've got a nice kitchen, or you have some place that you can see people in your own home. You might see people in the park if the weather's nice. You might see people at a local cafe. Right? There's lots of different ways to do this. You don't have to be picturing like a fully outfitted facility for you to go to in order to start doing your work as a practitioner.
Also, you don't need to make a huge investment in an apothecary. All you need to do is be very familiar with everything that Cambridge Naturals sells, right?
Or whatever your local herb shop
is. Get familiar with all the herbs that Whole Foods carries and be a Whole Foods herbalist, right? Be a Cambridge Naturals herbalist, right? And just tell your clients, okay, this is what I would recommend. These are the reasons I would recommend it. And I know you can get that at Whole Foods for $10. I know you can get that at Cambridge Naturals for whatever, you know? It's totally legit to do that. And that's another way that you can save money. At some point, you'll want to have your own apothecary. You probably already have your own apothecary, but you might not want to be giving that out to people because that might be for you. So this is a way that for very little or no investment, you can still be working with people and not get yourself into a place of debt. Even though it's so tempting to just go to the Mountain Rose website and buy everything. Also in this, in terms of not going into debt, it's really important not to go into energy debt either, right? You need to take care of yourself energetically. You need to make sure that there's time every week, even time every day, just to care for yourself. If you're not making yourself a pot of tea every day and taking the time to drink it, you can't serve anyone else, right? So fill your own bowl first, and then go and take care of everyone else. All right.
Do you want to just do this and then we'll take questions?
Yeah. So there's a few other things in here about advertising, getting compensated, how to grow. Don't worry, all the words are in there, commonwealthherbs.com/herbstock or the Herbstock website. I think the password is calendula 2016. But I do want to skip down to the bottom here. Be true to your nature, right? That's the most important part. You can't be an herbalist like somebody else is an herbalist. You can only be you, the herbalist. You can't be me, right?
I can't be you.
Well,
I really can't be you.
There are many herbalists who you will admire, but you can't be them, right? And you don't have to be them. Be who you are as an herbalist. Be in your integrity. Practice the way that you practice. It is legitimate. You don't need to be like somebody else to be doing it right, right? The way that you are an herbalist is right.
We've seen, you know, we've had a number of students get started and come through and kind of talk to them about their aspirations and their plans and all of that. And very often we'll see, like, the standard pattern start to emerge, right? Somebody says, well, I want to teach. And I'm like, okay, well, what kind of teaching do you want to do? Oh, well, you know, I'll do some evening classes, and then I'll do a 9-month apprenticeship, and then I'll do a longer clinical program, and then I'll do this, and then I'll do a weekend trip to someplace over there, and then we'll do it together. And you're like, yeah, that's because it's what everybody does, right? We do that, mostly.
We do.
You know, we're trying a few different things. But that might not actually be the right thing for them, right? Maybe it would be better for them to focus all of their teaching to be, we're going to go outside, and we're going to go hiking. And we're going to learn all the plants that we find as we go along, or we're going to do an herbal apprenticeship that's completely focused on the plants you find within the borders of Boston itself, right? And those are the only ones we're going to talk about, right? Whatever. There's lots of different ways to do it, but people will sort of say like, well, there's this model, and I have to be the model, right? I have to do all of the things.
Please don't be the model.
And not just because we're already. But
no, because there's so many languages and there's so many hearts and there's so many, we need every possible way. So you're not doing it wrong just because you don't look like the herbalist next door. You're doing it right.
Okay, so we wanted to leave a few minutes. I imagine that you came here for some specific reason. So does anybody have a particular question, maybe something we didn't address, or something you wanted some more detail on?
Yes, if you're already in debt and you're considering having your own business, whether it's an herbal business or anything else, pay off your debts first. Do what you got to do to pay your debts off first.
That's what I figured.
Yeah, because otherwise you're just going to dig yourself in deeper. Yeah, and then you'll be driven by fear, and that's not a comfortable way to be.
Yeah, it's hard to open your heart to somebody when you're sort of like feeling the clock tick at you. You know, whether that's a money clock or a time clock or whatever else, you know. I do know of herbalists who will brag about seeing 11 clients in a day, and I just can't imagine it on any level, right? On the level of, like, how would I give good advice? How would I do self-care? How would I keep their names straight? I just, like, you know, I feel like I would be so lost trying to do that, and I don't know. I don't think that would work out. So that's a microcosm of what we're talking about more generally, yes.
Any other resources you guys would recommend, especially if you plant like when you're hiking or something, trying to figure it out?
The Peterson's Field Guide is very good in terms of identification.
Yeah.
Once you've identified it, you should study it in as many different places as possible. Don't just look at one book. I do like The Earthwise Herbal by Matt Wood. I also like Practical Herbalism by Henrietta Kress. There's a billion books that I like.
Yeah. You know, Henrietta's website is a really useful one.
Yeah.
This is Henrietta's-herb. But if you just type into Google Henrietta's herb, you know, it'll come up. And there you can use her search bar, and it will give you results from like 90 different herbals. A lot of them are from the period between like 1800 and 1940. So you can get some historical perspectives on how people were using this. That period's important in herbal history because that's the time when like university-level clinical herbalism was the primary form of healthcare for the majority of people in this country. So these were folks writing these books after 50 years of practice using these herbs day in and day out. Right, so it's really valuable. Again, it's not everything. You still got to have your own experience and the experience of people in your generation, but it's a really good place to start. And I'll tell you, that'll give you more like practical, useful information than you'll get from like a database that lists out all the chemicals that are in it or all of the double-blind, placebo-controlled studies that were done on those herbs. That doesn't always give you actionable information, right? So we like to go back to people who are really using it day in, day out.
One other source for you is go on lots of herb walks. So we do 2 herb walks every month. One is the first Wednesday of the month at noon at the Harvard Boathouse, and we go along the Charles River. And one is the second Wednesday of every month at 5:30 p.m. In Brookline at Hall's Pond. And so those are really good ways to start learning plants so that maybe you won't know everything that you see when you go out into the world, but you'll know some, and that'll help you make differentiations. The more that you look at plants, even if you don't know who they are, the more that you will understand what you're looking at and how to differentiate what you're looking at.
Yeah.
So that a lot.
Yeah, you gotta break down the wall of green phenomenon. You know, like you go into the forest and you're like, plants are here, great. You know?
And it takes some trees too.
Yeah. And it takes a long time to kind of be able to see like, wait, you're sort of like scanning your eyes over and then you're like, that was a yarrow over there, you know? But that will come. That will come. Yeah.
Did you have
I just wanna say there's also like a Facebook group specifically just for plant identification.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, those are handy.
Speaking of Facebook groups, I just started one called Boston Herbalists. So feel free to join it.
We had a question here.
Yeah. Have you ever worked directly with a doctor? So I know there are lots of functional medicine doctors in the area who are interested in herbalism. Have you ever worked with them on cases? That's one question. My second question is, what resources do you really like for reading about the latest scientific studies
For the recording, that was, what resources do you like for finding scientific studies that have to do with herbs, and have you ever worked in tandem or in teams with doctors? Do you want to do the...
Yeah, so for finding info on studies, there's a couple of good places there. If you go to the AHG's website, the American Herbalist Guild, they have a thing you can sign up for, and it will just email you. It's like they run a search, like a set of search terms every day or every week or something like that, and then it'll just spit out all of the things that hit that, and it's like, you know, herbs used in humans and this and that and the other. And so that's pretty good. I like to watch that. I also set up some Google Scholar alerts for plants that I'm particularly interested in, and then whenever a new study is published that includes that Latin name, then it gets right to me. And that sort of gives you a sense of like what's going on in that world. You can see, one pattern I've observed over the last couple of years, for instance, is there's a lot of good studies coming from like Taiwan and China and Korea, where they're assessing herbs with the help of a traditional practitioner who's identifying a pattern according to the principles of traditional medicine, right? So they'll be like, okay, we had a TCM-trained doctor, he's been in practice for a long time, he said all these people had liver yang rising, right? And so we used that as the sorting method for choosing people to be in our study, and then we looked at the influence of the herb on that. So it's sort of trying to combine the benefits of a random or a controlled trial with the assessment or the categorization skills from traditional medicine. So that's been very interesting to me to see that happen, and I think that that gives you a lot better, a lot more, again, more actionable kind of information about how to actually put that into practice. So those are some ways that I've done that. Another one that's really useful, you might know about this already, but scihub.org or .net, or actually it's now .io because they have to keep moving it around. This is a way to get full text access to studies that might not actually have been there. It's sci-hub.io. So that can be very helpful if you want to determine whether a particular study is actually actually has the information that its abstract claims it has, which is not always the case, but you need to get the full text for that. So this one's really useful for that.
And in terms of working in team with doctors, yes, we definitely do that. Sometimes that has happened. I've had clients who wanted to stop taking psychiatric meds. Those need to be titrated very carefully. And so I've worked in consultation with their nurse practitioners to work them down. The nurse practitioner worked on titrating them off, and I worked on other strategies that we were going to use between food, lifestyle changes, herbs, and other things that we were going to use to help do the work that they used to be using the drugs for. But it's not okay for me to say, you know, I don't really think you need that lithium. You should just get off it, and I'll just help you titrate off that, and we'll use these herbs instead. That's not okay. But working together in consultation with their nurse practitioner so that the nurse practitioner is doing one half and I'm doing the other half, and we're both supporting this person in the middle, that's totally legit. Another place where I do this work is with oncology clients. Sometimes, for example, I'll have a person come who has cancer and they have the surgery, they decline the chemo, and they want to use herbs instead, herbs and nutrition and other things instead of chemo. So this is probably a good time to say also, I'm not a nutritionist, I'm not a registered dietitian, so we do have to kind of be careful around that. But it's always okay to encourage a person to eat more vegetables and to talk about maybe these might be some foods that you might have allergies or sensitivities to, and I can help you do an elimination diet around that. And I can certainly educate people for it. But so that's a really good way. There, I've had clients who have said, well, I've been diagnosed with early stage cancer and I don't want to have anything done except natural therapies. But that person wants to still work in coordination with an oncologist. And so in that case, what we'll do is the oncologist will set a particular testing threshold. And as long as the person stays under that threshold, then the natural therapies are allowed to proceed. And if that person gets close to that threshold, then the oncologist will say, I think that this is not working and we need to go ahead and take conventional action. So that's a really good way we can work in partnership. And a third way that we can work in partnership is maybe the person has surgery, has chemo, but wants herbs to help them get through the chemo more easily. And so that's another time that you want to be in coordination with their oncologist so that you're giving herbs that are working together with those chemo drugs and not having any potential interactions. There's a lot of research around that, especially in Russia. And so a lot of times that also comes down to educating the oncologist and presenting them various studies to help them say, oh yeah, okay, well actually Eleuthero does look like there's a lot of science behind it and that might be something worth trying or,
It occurred to me a couple other sources for like somebody collecting a bunch of information on herbs rather than like trying to do it on your own. The American Botanical Council has a thing called Herbalgram. And that is very strongly centered on scientific trials as the sources of information they draw from. So the ABC Herbalgram, that's pretty good. You can also go ahead and look at the publications from the Commission E in Germany, which is roughly equivalent to a branch of the FDA that's involved in regulation of herbs, right? So we gave you some of our, like, what are the negative aspects of that for the individual practitioner, but On the positive side, they do have some really clear and well-presented collections of scientifically derived information on plants there. So that's a place you can check out as well. All right, any other questions kicking around in here? No? Well, if others occur to you, feel free to reach out to us. We're going to be here all weekend. Our table's right on the corner there. You can also check out our website or send us an email anytime.
One last thing to throw out there is that whatever it is that you do, whatever path you want to follow, don't ever stop learning. Don't ever stop studying. Study every single day. Right? It's been 18 or 19 years. I should probably do some math. But I study every day. Right? Don't stop studying because you're never going to know it all. So whatever it is, just keep studying all the time.
This concludes the class. For more information about the Commonwealth Center for Holistic Herbalism, visit our website at commonwealthherbs.com.